In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I are going to be talking about more tips for identifying startup ideas. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 138. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Mike?
I have spent more time in airports and traveling this past week than I have actually working.
Really? What, have you had delays or canceled flights?
Both. Last week, I was supposed to take off from San Antonio. I ended up trying to fly out in the morning. I got to the airport. I got up at, it was like 5 o'clock in the morning to get there. And I get there and my flight had been canceled. I was so ticked.
That's brutal. So you just waited for one later in the day?
They put me on a later flight and then my connection was delayed. Then I had like mechanical problems. Then on my way down here this week, I had more mechanical problems. And then they had a flight attendant who couldn't make the flight and they had to find somebody else. And it was just like I said, I've spent probably 45, 50 hours in travel over the past week.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous.
That feels like such a waste of time too.
It is. It's totally a waste of time. Delays that I've been encountering recently have been mostly weather related. There's been a few mechanical problems. You know, they got to wait for the weather to clear or they got to go around it or...
Hey, so I'm back home after I was on the coast of California around Pismo Beach, Shell Beach area for 10 days. I was out there with my six-year-old. That's also the reason the quality wasn't so great last week is the Wi-Fi. No matter where I went... No matter how good the Wi-Fi tested on speed test, there was something wrong with it. I was in a cafe, the Wi-Fi was screaming fast, and then there was so much background noise that it was literally going to be a huge distraction to the podcast. So I switched to another cafe, and the Wi-Fi was terrible. So I drove back to the apartment that we stay at, and the Wi-Fi went down at that point. Normally, it would be fast enough, but it went down. The owners weren't there to reboot the router. So I had a MiFi 4G LTE router that was clocking at like 11 megs down and 5 or 6 up, which is ample, should be ample to record over Skype. And yet, it just wasn't working. Yeah, that was the final quality that you did here with all the breakups. You know, if you heard how crappy Mike's, the buffering and all of his voice quality was, that was recording on that. So it feels good to be home to a connection that works and that is solid.
Yeah, that's what we refer to as gremlins in the machine, when just when you're trying to get something done, like the whole thing just falls over on itself.
Right. And I had spent a lot of time thinking about it. I recorded two different podcasts last week and I was scoped out. I mean, I went to all these coffee shops and scoped out the speed test, you know, oh, no problem. This one's fine. And then I had backup options and yet they just all seemed to fall through. So I'm not sure if the 4G MiFi, if it was its fault or if it's still, you know, you're on a hotel connection, if it's a combination of the two things, but I'd be interested to try it again at some point because it just feels like the 4G MiFi should be able to handle it. But of course, it really didn't.
I mean, you might also think that it'd be the latency between that machine and they're out there on the internet or, you know, with Skype and everything. And that didn't seem to be a problem either for either you or me. So I don't know really what the issue is. Like I said, you know, just gremlins or ghosts in the machine.
Right. And so an update on stuff I've been working on recently. You know, at the beginning of the year, I said I wanted to launch 3 video courses this year, and I just launched my first one today, finally, that How to Hire a VA for Your Startup training course launched to my email list. And so it's just in early access right now, so to speak. Surely I'll have a public URL here in the next week or two that I'll announce on the podcast. It feels good to get that out. We filmed it late last year and had all the editing done by January, and then I just haven't had the bandwidth basically to get it all up and get all the resources up there, and had to record some companion screencasts and then to, you know, draft the emails. And it's always more work than I think it's going to be to get a product out the door. You think, I'll just use an email template I already have, but you really want it to be good and you really want to customize it when you're emailing people about it. So I spent several hours last week and drafted it up, and, you know, kind of in the middle of the launch, and it just feels good to have it out there. Then the last thing is with Drip, after a couple of rocky weeks, customer number one, a new customer number one with a pretty simple use case is getting set up as we speak. And so that's the other kind of victory for the week. But hopefully by, you know, next podcast recording, I should have some news about a customer number one and potentially working on a customer number two. There's definitely I have a list of people to get going. It's just all about, you know, picking ones that can use the app based on the features it has right now.
Very cool. So today we're going to be talking about more tips for identifying startup ideas. And it should really be the problems you're thinking about trying to solve. Because an idea, you can sit there and have all the ideas in the world, but then when you sit down and you build something, unless you're actually solving a problem, it's very difficult to get people to pay for that solution to the problem because they never had it to begin with. I mean, we get a lot of email from people saying, hey, I've built this product. How do I market it? How do I sell it? And it's like, well, who were you talking to in order to find out if they were interested in paying for it to begin with? And if the answer is nobody, then you've got an immediate problem that you've got to deal with. So at that point, it's not just a marketing problem. It's trying to find out whether people even want what you've built, because even though you may value the time and effort that you've put into it, other people don't necessarily value it.
I think my advice would be at this point, after going through this stuff for years with different entrepreneurs, is if you have an idea that doesn't solve a problem that people know they have, or if you are such a forward thinker that you know you want to innovate and you want to be a Steve Jobs or an Ev Williams and come up with things that are just ahead of the curve, then you need to go raise funding, because that's what those people do, right? You need millions, if not tens of millions of dollars to make it that long. I mean, if you look at what Ev Williams did with Blogger and with Twitter and what Steve Jobs did with Apple and Next and Pixar, like they needed enormous sums of money and they were visionary, you're right, but they had to outlast all the years of not having revenue, essentially. And so if you are going to go the bootstrap route, which is what we talk about, then you absolutely need to start with problems, not ideas.
So the idea for this episode came from a Quora thread that was all about trying to find and identify ideas for startups, and we'll link to that in the show notes. The three things that kind of factor into this are luck or spontaneousness, and that's if you're trying to sit around and just think of ideas and an idea comes to you, or you're not even trying to think about ideas and then you just think of a startup idea, that's where the luck or spontaneousness comes into it. The second one is insider knowledge. So if you've worked in an industry or you know somebody who does, that's what is considered insider knowledge. And then the third one is just doing research and trying to figure out different problems that people are having, talking to people, and generating ideas for problems to solve from there in a way that you address those ideas, you look at them, and trying to figure out which ones will and will not be profitable, and then choose the path that you want to go down.
Yeah, so these might sound familiar. You know, these are all related to what we talked about in episode 128, which is where we analyzed Paul Graham's essay on finding startup ideas. While these aren't direct repeats, they definitely tie in. And you'll notice that as you research finding startup ideas, you will start to see some repetition. And that's a good thing, right? It means that there are repeatable ways and there are some best practices or at least some good ways that people do come up with multiple startup ideas. Now, there's always a way, like Mike said, to be spontaneous or to get lucky. But since it's not a reliable method, it's not something that I like to teach, right? It's not something that you want to tell people to do, because that's kind of the other, you have it or you don't. You're either Steve Jobs and Ev Williams or you're not. We're going to try to keep this to repeatable things that most people can do.
I think the other part that kind of goes into luck is that you have to think about the ideas that you're trying to come up with and come up as many as you possibly can so that you do have good selection to choose from. Because when you're out in the dating world, or you know, you don't marry the first person that you meet. I mean, most people don't, but and sometimes there are people who that works out for. But for the vast majority of people, that just is not going to work out. So why would you run the first startup idea you have? Definitely take some time, look around, try and figure out which ideas are viable and which ones are not. And from there, that's where you're making your choices. And that applies not just to the luck factor, but also insider knowledge and then researching. So let's talk about the insider knowledge piece. One of the things that you can do to tap into problems that you know you would have access to as part of insider knowledge is not only looking at the businesses that you've been involved in, but tapping into your network of people. So whether you're using Facebook or LinkedIn, reach out to the people that you know. Ask them the types of problems that they face, because that's a really good way to try and figure out what sorts of businesses are having those problems. And we've talked about B2B versus B2C in the past. And what you're really trying to focus on is what problems are having at work. You don't want to ask what problems are people having in general, because you'll get this gamut of things that is not really going to help you very much. Ask them specifically for what types of problems they're having at work. And this may not be something you just want to blast out there. You may want to ask some very specific people, especially people who tend to be up in the management level or who are actively thinking about these things and looking for solutions to those, to the types of problems that they encounter at work.
So when it said insider knowledge in this core thread, I thought it actually meant that you have insider knowledge and that the research piece was you contacting people.
I kind of looked at that and said, well, that's only one side of it. I don't think it's the whole picture. I think that there's two sides of it. One, you can look at just the problems that you've had access to. But, you know, I've done a lot of consulting over the years. And one of the things that I run into and find is that I tend to know about a lot of different environments, whereas most companies I go and do consulting work for, I'll walk in there and they'll say, well, this is how we do things. And I'll say, well, have you thought about doing this way or that way or et cetera? And they just have no idea. So for me to go in and be able to recognize that this is one way that they've done it and there are 50 other ways of doing it, and they look at that same exact problem, they only have one or two ways in their head. So it's a different mentality of being able to of searching out into your network of people that you know and asking them for advice, because obviously there's a piece of your experience, but then there's also the network of people that you have. And I just feel like it's a lot more valuable for you to tap into that network than to just solely rely on your own experience.
Yeah, I think there's two sides to it. We've talked a little bit about it in the past for sure, but I think a big factor in the success of your product, or one factor, is if you are customer zero. I think it can be a big benefit because you do know what to build and you do know how you want it to work and you do know the problem that you're trying to solve. The other side of that coin is, like you said, you can feasibly then solve it too narrow, right? Too narrow a problem, or build too narrow a solution, because you're only solving your problem. If you don't listen to any external feedback, then that's when you can get in trouble and build something that no one except for yourself wants. And I mean, you and I have both seen founders who they build an app and they say, well, I'm going to use it anyway, so I'm going to go ahead and build it, and then I'll see if there's a market for it. And that's okay if you truly do mean that, and that the 400 hours you're going to spend building a simple project management app or something, if it's truly justified and you really are okay with that, then so be it. But what I typically find is that they build it and then it's so much maintenance headache and it's so much ongoing, you know, anytime they need a new feature, they need to build it, that they wind up switching to Basecamp later anyways, because it's easier and they don't have to maintain hosting and all that stuff. I guess what I'm saying is there's an easy trap to fall into of thinking that being customer zero or eating your own dog food or solving your own pain point, like people say, is not necessarily the golden ticket, right? It's one factor, but it can also be kind of a trap. So I guess insider knowledge is vital and absolutely a way to increase the chance that you will succeed, but it's also something that you need to watch out for as you're searching for ideas, and especially as you're building them out, more importantly. I've been dealing with this with Drip because I had an original idea and I vetted it with, you know, a dozen people, and then we got months down the line and I realized that, you know, I built something that I really wanted. Do these people still want it? And that's where I had to send out a big email survey, and I validated that assumption. But there was a point when I sent that email that I thought, wow, it could come back and they could say, you know what, you basically screwed up and you solved your own problem. And it wouldn't have been scrap the app, but it would have been, okay, we need to spend 2 to 4 weeks here and build a bunch of features to make up for the lack of direction that we've had. Luckily, it didn't turn out that way, but I can see how insider knowledge can easily kind of blind you and make you overconfident in your idea to build something that people want.
Yeah, I completely agree with that being a trap that you could fall into, where you're building something that is for you and you turn around and resell it to other people. I mean, I think that that's part of the issue I have with a lot of people who have looked at what 37 Signals has done. And it worked out great for them, but it's not to say that it's going to work out great for everybody, because there's lots of people out there who build something to scratch their own itch, and it just never goes anywhere because it's just so narrow and they don't want to genericize it. They want to solve their own problem. So it's definitely something to look out for. And that's part of why I kind of brought in this idea of tapping into your network, because if you're actively looking for somebody who has that problem and you're working with them to solve their problem, one of the things that you want to do is make sure that you've got more than one person lined up who has the same problem. And that's how you would kind of gauge which types of problems you're going to go out and try and solve. You're not going to solve a problem that only has one person who says, yeah, I would pay for a solution to this, when you have a second idea where there's like 10 or 20 or 30 people who say, hey, I have that exact same problem or something very similar, and I'd like to pay for it as well.
Right. And I think instead of having one person who has that same problem, my rule of thumb these days is I want to find 10 people who not only have the problem, but are willing to pay the price that I name up front. And that's kind of my rule of thumb. I think Jason Cohen did 30 before he, you know, he found 30 people before he did WP Engine. I think the number's somewhere between 10 and 30 is my guess. And it depends on how much time you want to spend, how much confidence you have in the idea, how much risk you're willing to take on, how much time you're willing to invest up front before you start writing code.
Yeah, I talked to Jason Cohen about that at one point, and he said that one of the things that he did was you just keep asking the questions. Or he kind of felt that if you keep asking people the question about whether or not they have that problem, when you start hearing the same responses over and over again and you're not really learning anything, then that's about the time to stop. And then you go back and you start listing out the exact features that you're going to build for your minimum viable product to move forward with that. So we've talked a lot about the insider knowledge piece of it. Now let's talk about researching. And one of the big issues with doing research to find a product idea is that it takes work. There's just no way around it. If you can't come up with problems that you're interested in solving from your friends or from yourself, then you need to look for people that you don't know. One of the ways that I think would be a really good way to find problems that need to be solved is to troll customer forums for any large company. You're going to find that in those forums, there are a lot of people who are making complaints to the company about different things that are not working or that things should be different in the product. These are things that you can kind of leverage as ideas. But one of the things that you have to be careful about is that you're not going to build a piece of functionality for that product that the company is then going to come in and implement themselves that's going to put you out of business. What you're really looking for is an add-on product, a plug-in, or something along those lines that you're going to be able to leverage from that customer base such that it's going to help and assist those customers and is going to be such a small piece of revenue that company is not going to go ahead and implement it out from under you and kill your business.
First of all, I like the idea of lurking on large company customer forums because you're going to see a lot of complaints and a lot of things that need to be fixed. I think the point you raised about building just an add-on is a really good idea. I've been thinking about this concept, and I heard it on a podcast, and someone said, are you building a feature, are you building a product, or are you building a business? And especially if you're early on in your career and you're trying to get that early win under your belt, that first app that takes hold and makes you some money and allows you to quit your job or at least gets you part of the way there, I think you need to think about features rather than building products or businesses because they're faster to get out of the gate. They're more easy to be acquired. If you build an add-on to another system and it takes off and does well, then that system is much more likely to buy you. So if you built something great that hooked into MailChimp or that hooked into Basecamp or that hooked into, you know, Norton Antivirus or anything that needed an add-on, it could be a real benefit to you. And so I think in the early days, think features. In the old days, I had kind of a negative thought about this, like, oh, if you only build a feature, then the main app is they're just going to build it and put you out of business. But I don't believe that anymore. Like, it's pretty rare that a large company is going to move fast enough to put a little guy like you out of business, especially, let's say you build a little WordPress plugin or a tie-in to Basecamp, and it's making you $1,000 a month or $3,000 a month. The odds of them implementing that are actually pretty small. And if you do have success and you're doing a good job supporting it, you're either going to build a relationship with them to where they're not going to want to put you out of business or where they're going to be more likely to acquire you than build it themselves. Give that more thought. And then once you've built some smaller plugins and you're kind of stair-stepping your way up like we've talked about, that's when you can think about building more full-fledged products. That's when you do start bringing other people into the mix because that just requires a lot more development, a lot more support, and a lot more things than you can do on your own.
Yeah, I was thinking back to Joel Spolsky's blog entry on platform vendors and talking about the copy-paste feature that wasn't on the iPhone and how there was kind of a rush of people who were trying to create all these different apps that will allow you to basically hack your way into creating some sort of a copy-paste feature in iOS. So there's a bunch of these things that came out, and then Apple came out and implemented copy-paste, and none of those products probably ever sold again. That's what I was thinking about when I was talking about trying to make sure that you're not doing things that that vendor is going to come in. Because if you are building a true add-on for that product, then they really are the platform that you're building for. So you have to just be aware of what sort of repercussions could come down the road from that.
That's true. And that is a counterexample to what I just said, actually. I was saying that, you know, you would have some success and they would acquire you. And obviously Apple didn't in those cases. So it can happen. I know Twitter has done the same. But I think more often than not, it's unlikely to happen, especially if you're not playing in those waters in particular. If you're playing with a little smaller player or a player who's maybe more aware of their ecosystem and cares more for it, like some of the, you know, Basecamp and MailChimp and those guys, I think they're just a lot less likely to do something so drastic.
Oh, I agree. So another thing that you can do in terms of research is do some consulting work for a while. I have a hard time advising people in many cases to switch over and do consulting. But the reality is that if you're doing consulting work, large companies always have problems that need to be solved. And most are willing to pay for solutions to those problems. And when working as a consultant for a lot of different companies, you get to see a lot of different problems. You get to see a lot of different situations where people are having problems with things. There is a huge, huge number of people who have just a wide array of skills, and not everybody's going to be able to do every job. Not everybody's going to be able to use the different pieces of software that are out there. So you can take a look at the software that they're using today and say, well, what do you like about it? What do you not like about it? And I'll give you a prime example, one that I've seen at many large companies is service desk software. If you're working with these companies where they have a ticketing system of any kind in their IT department, every single one of them will tell you that they hate it. And they're more than happy to tell you all the things that they hate about it. But if you look on the market for help desk software for that is geared for large enterprises, there are tons of options out there. They're configurable to the end of the world. So that's not an area that I would advise going in and trying to build. But at the same time, that's just one example of all the different types of things that people are more than willing to tell you about. They'll tell you that they don't like their ticketing system. They'll tell you that they don't like, you know, their asset tracking system. They'll tell you that they don't like their software deployment system. And if you just start asking questions about, well, why don't you like this? What doesn't work for you? What does work? How does the vendor treat you? You get to get a feel for how the competition acts, how they build features, what their release schedules are, and you can gain a lot of that insider knowledge that you're going to need to beat them in your marketing collateral.
I think that's an interesting example you bring up about help desk software. Something just popped into my head, and it's that you need to pick a niche that's small enough that you are going to be one of the best marketers in that niche. But the niche has to be large enough that you can gain enough revenue to make it worth your while. And so if you're an experienced marketer and or you have a lot of money at your back and or you have the insider knowledge, you know, you have all those founder qualities, what do we call it, the founder test. If you have a lot of those in your favor, then you can pick a larger, more competitive niche. If you have experience starting these businesses and getting them going, then that's where you dive in. And I do think that, you know, a knowledgeable, experienced founder with the wind at their back could do some damage in the help desk software space. But if you're a first-time entrepreneur and you don't have the wind at your back, you don't have the money, you don't have the insider knowledge, and you are just trying to get your feet wet with this, then diving into the general help desk space, you're probably going to get creamed. And what you want to do is instead niche it way down and maybe just build a WordPress plugin that duplicates some help desk functionality, or build just a single add-on to an existing help desk functionality and just get out there and learn the marketing and learn what it takes to get an app out the door. And then as your marketing prowess grows and as maybe your bankroll grows and as all those founder test attributes grow, that's when you can dive into the larger and larger niches. You can't just look at the successful founders that we all look at, you know, Peldy, Patrick McKenzie, Jason Cohen, and say, wow, well, he does it, then I'm going to do it, because you don't have the experience that they do, and you don't have the money, and you don't have the contacts, and you don't have these other things that play into their favor. So that's where you do have to start small, I believe. You know, if you really want to be in the help desk space, then you just niche it down to the point where you are one of the best, if not, you know, the best marketer in that small space. And then you work up from there. And at the same time, you do want to make sure that that niche is large enough that it's worth your time to build it.
One other thing that you can do in terms of researching is ask the company that you work for what they're spending money on every month. The accountants may be a little bit tight-lipped about this, but you can ask them in a general sense, because they're not going to come out and say, well, here's our payroll information. But if you work at a large enough company, and I tend to think of like small to mid-sized companies as anywhere from, you know, 20 to 70 or 80 people. If you work in a company that size, you can generally get on a first name basis with whoever is running the books, and you can ask them and say, you know, what are we spending money on every month that could possibly be done a little bit better? What amounts of money are we spending on different things? And if you can get into those types of conversations and ask them those questions, and you obviously have to tell them why you're asking, but you know, you're looking for problems to solve. You're looking for ways to save them money. And if you phrase it like that to them, they may very well be willing to share that information with you. And you can find some interesting things. Like you might find, oh, well, we're spending $500 to $1,000 a month on help desk software that we're leasing. And as I said before, there are lots and lots of help desk companies out there, and that's just one example. But there's all these other things that the business has as problems that you could look at, and based on what you're currently spending money on, you could use those as a list to figure out what sorts of things that you might want to build. Because if your company is paying a significant amount of money for it, chances are really good that other companies are as well.
So you're basically saying, look where the company's already spending money and try to get between them and that and the money they're spending.
Yep, that's exactly right.
Cool.
Some general guidelines that you might want to keep in mind are, when you're looking for problems to solve, make sure you find that problem space interesting. The last thing you want to do is go into a space where it is the most boring thing on the planet to you, because you're probably going to lose motivation for going after it. Even if there's a lot of money there, it can be very demotivational to have to work on something that you just do not have a feel for and you have no interest in working with. Another thing that you need to do is make sure that you keep in mind that if you're going against a gorilla in a space, make sure you choose a very narrow niche in that, inside of that market. You don't want to go after like the enterprise help desk market, because that's going to be too much for you to try and go after. But what you could do is you could say, well, I'm going to build help desk applications for the metal manufacturing space. Maybe that's something that would yield an appropriate level of customers in that area that would allow you to put together a business.
I would also add that I would much prefer to go against a gorilla, you know, and niche it down, than to go against another startup or another single founder, because they're way more dangerous. They're more agile, and they're going to care much more about you trying to do your several $1,000 a month business than some $10 million, $100 million company is. They're not even going to notice you until it's, well, not until it's too late for them, but until you've basically had enough success that you can then move on.
And the last tip, as always, is to talk to customers before you write any code.
Yeah, I think I'd add one more here. It's to keep a notebook so that you remember the ideas. And not only ideas, so I've started, instead of just writing ideas down, now what I do is I'll write the idea itself, and then I'll say problem, colon, and I'll write down what problem does it solve, and then I'll say audience, or for whom, you know, whom does it solve. And having those three factors in place when I think about it so that I can refer back to that in the future is helpful. I think I bring it up every time we talk about startup ideas, but this act of writing them down and keeping them for the long term, it's definitely been very helpful for me, not only in taking ideas and launching them and moving forward, but just in sparking even offshoots and, you know, all kinds of stuff. It just unleashes creativity that you didn't realize that you had and that you will quickly forget. And having them written down and being able to reflect on them again later is more benefit than I think I can communicate.
You know, what you were just telling me reminded me of the book, A Business Model Generation, A Handbook for Visionaries, Game Changers, and Challengers, which kind of walks through deciding whether or not you have a business based on a variety of different factors. And, you know, some of the things that you just called out there in terms of audience and how you would reach them and what the problem is. A lot of that stuff is covered in that book. So we'll link to that in the show notes. It's definitely an interesting read for people who are still looking for ideas.
So to recap, we gave three tips today for identifying startup ideas. The first was luck or spontaneity. The second one was insider knowledge. And the third was researching your niche.
If you have a question for us, you can call our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email it to us at questions@startupsforrestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us in iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsforrestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.